It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hello and welcome to the Phileas Club, the show where we get people from around the world to tell you how they saw the news from the past month. This is episode 46 for April 2012. Hello everyone, and welcome to the Phileas Club, the show where we get people from different countries and cultures around the world to revisit the news from the past month and tell you how it was covered and how they perceived it in their respective countries. So hopefully you get a different view on the world and on the news you've heard about for a few weeks. Today, I'm very pleased to welcome Mr. Charles from Australia. I can't remember if I can say your last name or if it's a secret.
It's not a secret to say my last name.
All right. So Charles Cox from Australia.
Thank you, Patrick. How are you?
Wow, you sound awake. What time is it for you?
It is 2:30.
All right.
In the morning.
Yes, I assumed. It's 6:30 for me in the afternoon. What time is it for you, Paulo from South Africa?
We're on the same time zone, so 6:30.
Well, that's anticlimactic. we have
national awareness.
Sorry?
We have a different, you're getting your summer and we're getting our winter now, so different sides of the world.
That's cool. Well, although with the weather we've been getting in Paris, it feels like autumn, definitely. It's been raining nonstop for 6 weeks. It feels like we've swapped weather with London or something. And last but not least, we have Letad. I always try to pronounce your name right. Usually you tell me I do okay. How's it this time?
Yeah, you're great.
Okay.
You're great.
Thank you. You're too kind. Letad from from Thailand.
PM. It's 11:32 p.m.
Okay, that's still reasonable.
Yeah.
I don't feel too bad. The only person I really feel bad for is Charles, as usual. So... I guess we're gonna be okay. It's been a year since you've been on the show, Letad. So thank you very much for coming back. I think so, hasn't it?
Okay. Well, I guess maybe.
Yeah. Maybe I half think a year. It's always
great to be back.
Thank you. I thought you were gonna say something else. It's always a pain to be there. Yeah. All right, so I hope things are going well in Bangkok, and I hope you guys are pumped for an awesome show of lots of international stories that have covered and spanned the world, because things happen in the world, right? No, not really. So we were discussing before we started the show, and so for me, I haven't really seen anything about anything happening in the world, because France has been squarely focused on the presidential election, and we've been talking basically about that only for the past month. There's been a lot about Syria also, but it could be summed up in the UN is getting pissed and Syria is still not doing what they said they would do. And that's about it. It's the summary of the past few months in Syria, and it hasn't changed. So I don't know if Syria qualifies as a story we're going to be wanting to talk about. But I think everyone on the show here today agrees that there hasn't been many major international stories, right?
Yeah, definitely from our end. I mean, there's been stories, obviously, but nothing other than the tsunami warnings in Indonesia. From my point of view.
Okay, I haven't even heard about that. But the
French elections have been getting a bit of coverage here.
Ooh, woohoo! French rules. France rules. Okay. All right. So I guess what we're going to be doing for this show is that we're going to we're not going to have the international stories section because, as I was saying, not really anything major happening, at least that we can see. So if none of us has heard about anything worth mentioning, I guess it's not all that major anyway. If you guys listening think that we are completely missing out on some major event happening, then please, by all means, let us know and comment in the article for the show or send me hateful tweets. But for now, what we're going to do, as I said, is that we're just going to be covering our respective local stories. You know what? I'm going to go first because I'm the main host and it's my show, so I can do whatever I want. Does that work with everyone?
Sounds great. Tell us your... because obviously we're all seeing outside perspectives of what's going on in France. So what's been your view on what's happened with the elections? Has it gone well? Have people been happy with the results?
So I guess there are two main aspects of the election in France. So for those who don't know, it's the presidential elections in France, and unlike some other countries, the presidential election is really, really important because the president is actually the head of the state and makes all the decisions. The actual head of the government is the prime minister, but the president has more power. Comparable to what's happening in to the system in the U.S. more than in other countries where the president is, you know, a figurehead more than an actual person deciding things.
Does the president run the executive branch of government, Patrick?
It's the prime minister, but the president chooses the prime minister, and he basically tells him what to do. So the prime minister will head the government under the leadership of the president. So
basically, the president has most power, or he oversees most things.
Yes,
delegates to the prime minister. Yeah,
I'm sorry.
In terms of power, do you mean like
Charles?
Okay.
I was asking, does he then delegate to the prime minister that authority?
Yes, okay. He does. And the prime minister obviously has a lot of authority. He forms the government, he names the ministers with the president. I don't know how else to describe it. It's really, the president is the main guy. He's the dude in the French government.
Okay.
Yeah. Do you mean by power like influence, or does he have like some executive power to make decisions or veto decisions?
The parliament still votes on every, you know, law and main decision for the country, and the ministers will have the oversight of their respective areas. But if the president calls them and says, you should do this, then they're going to do that. They're going to do what he says. He has veto power for some things. He can call referendums, but mostly he can dissolve the assembly, the parliament. He can name the prime minister, and he can fire the prime minister. So, yeah, he will decide how the country is run. So I was saying, we had two main aspects of the election. We had the first turn of the election with 10 candidates, I believe, and the second turn is a week away from now. The first turn saw the two main candidates come ahead, so that is Nicolas Sarkozy, the current president, and François Hollande, the person that most people believe will become the president after the second turn. François Hollande is the representative of the Socialist Party, and Sarkozy is the right-wing, the Conservative Party representative. But the main story was, of course, about the third man, or the third woman, rather, who was Marine Le Pen, the right-wing representative. She's the Front National, the National Front person, and she came in third with, on the day of the election, we thought it was 20% of the vote. It turns out it's a little bit under 18, but it's still the best score they've ever done, and it's way above anyone else coming after her. The one after, basically there were two, I don't know if it's far left, but it's definitely left of the Socialist Party. The guy got 11%, and if you know anything about France, you'll know that left of the Socialist Party in France means probably horrible communist for anyone else in the world. Which it's without the joke, it's almost true. I mean, it verges on communism. It's not quite communism. It's more socialism, but it's quite extreme even for us. So he did get 11%, which is not nothing, of course, which speaks to the amount of left-wing enthusiasts we have in France.
That's quite a large percentage, 11% for such a, in your word, with the way you're describing it, quite a radical change in the way things would be run.
Definitely. No one expected him to win, no matter what happened. So right. It wasn't like people were going to get him elected. But it's definitely showing what their leanings, their political leanings are. Want to specify again, he's not a communist. He's just left of the Socialist Party. And then we had 9% for the center guy. And both of those were disappointed. They were hoping to make a lot more, around 15, maybe more. And they were disappointed. And obviously, the surprise came from the Front National. And now the game has started with both remaining candidates, which are Sarkozy and Hollande, who are sort of... It's a strange situation where Hollande is expected to win. I think the latest numbers give him 54% or around that number. And basically, in order to get elected, most people agree that he just has to not mess up. And Sarkozy, on the other hand, has to convince people from the far right to vote for him and people from the center to also vote for him. So it's a very... Because surprisingly, 20% of the electors of the voters for the National Front actually vote left-wing, which I don't really understand how it works. But apparently they are angry and they vote for the National Front on the first turn. So both of them, but Sarkozy a lot more clearly and a lot more... with a lot more controversy, have been saying things that could appeal to the National Front voters. Things like, I respect the people who vote for the National Front. They are expressing a frustration, and we don't have a right to... we don't have the right to judge them, because basically the reaction, the immediate reaction was a little bit of panic, which is understandable because it's really far right. They are xenophobic. I think I don't know if we can call them xenophobic, and I don't know if me saying that they might not be xenophobic, how it will be, it would be received in France. It might be taken as an incredible, as something that cannot be said. Basically, the National Front is completely ostracized and considered untouchable. They are the plague. And certainly they're far right and they're dangerous for democracy in some respects. And I want to make this clear. I don't think they should be the ones to be in power in any way. But the fact that they are being so demonized or so condemned unilaterally is, in my opinion, a little bit counterproductive, because we don't even try to understand why the people who vote for them actually vote for them. And that is one of the problems that we're facing today. I'm ranting. I'll do that for another 60 seconds and then stop. One of the reasons I think the National Front is getting so many votes is the fact that France is a very multicultural country. We have identities and people from all over Europe. We are at the crossings of Europe and Africa and other regions of the world. We have people from everywhere. You will be hard-pressed to find someone in the country who doesn't at least know someone whose parents aren't French. You know, we have, and that has been a strength of the country. But on the other hand, we have a deep fear of patriotism. And whenever someone says wants to be proud of France as his country and his, you know, his home, it's seen as suspect. We shouldn't be too expensive in our pride of the country. So what that does, and there are reasons for this, you know, I'm sure Second World War and the values exalted by the Vichy government, which was obviously allied with Nazi Germany, which were family, work, and country, had a bounce back effect, which means these values were suspect after that. But the result is a lot of people feel like, I believe a lot of people feel like we have this multicultural nation, and when they try to get a sense of identity, a lot of people, and mainly the left of the political spectrum, says, no, you can't. You cannot say you're proud to be French in that way. You can't, you know, announce, if you fly a flag, for example, in your home, people are going to look at it and think, why is he doing that? You know, maybe on the national holiday, you know, the Bastille Day, you can do that. But even then, it will be suspect if you do it.
It's not like the States where everybody has a flag flying outside their house. And, you know, yeah. It's very patriotic to symbolize.
Well, that's where my thinking came from, because the state is even more than France, a country with a lot of different, you know, people. There are no people who are from the United States. Everyone comes from somewhere else, almost, yeah,
but
obviously.
At the same time, I think those people who have who are in the United States and obviously have heritage from other parts of the world, they are far more assimilated than the people that you're talking about in France and South Africa. We also have a similar identity issue with, because we've got a lot of people from different parts of the world living in South Africa. And
I'm sure that's true. And I think one of the reasons why they're not as assimilated in France, it might be that we don't have an identity, a pride in their French identity to offer them.
Do you find that the original French people who came from France, they don't accept the foreign people as open armed as other countries, or they would say, well, you're not really French because you haven't been here as long as my family's, you know?
I'm sure there are some people like that. And at least part of the voters for the Front National, the National Front, are those people. I'm certain they exist.
In South Africa, we had in the past definitely that issue of, like, we had a lot of immigrants from Europe, obviously, and they didn't really assimilate into the Afrikaans or South African population because they weren't accepted. They were more seen as foreigners in the sense that they are, you know, they came here from Europe. They're not. Yeah. They didn't struggle as.
Yeah, there is this feeling, certainly, but at the same time, the feeling is also directed towards people who came from North Africa, who are second, third generation, even in France, and who are of, you know, North African heritage, sometimes Muslims, but they feel French. I mean, it's not even that they feel French; they are French. They don't really know the country they are from. They don't. Sometimes they speak the language a little bit. From Algeria or Tunisia, they would speak Arabic a little bit, but not even that much. But the problem is they can't. And another reason I came to that conclusion was my fiancé, who's from Finland, was telling me it's very strange that you don't see flagpoles on the buildings. In Finland, you see flagpoles everywhere. And you have flags, you know, on many, many occasions, and people have an opportunity to be members of their country. And I think one of the reasons, of course, I don't want to say that's the only reasons, but one of the reasons why the frustration mounts so high is that whenever you want to say, I'm French and I'm proud to be French, you will see people from all over the political spectrum tell you, you know, look at you from the side and think, so you vote for the National Front then? And it's like, no, that's not at all what it is. It's a completely different matter. And the reason why this question is posed all the time might be one of the factors that gives votes to the National Front.
Yeah. Now, Patrick, what do the other parties campaign around? So I guess they don't go for like the nationalistic press.
No. Sarkozy certainly played on that a little bit. And he also goes above, sometimes above what's acceptable by the majority because he needs the National Front voters, I would think. But the center party votes on fiscal conservatism. Responsibility. The left wing votes against, you know, campaigns against capitalism. Their slogan was let the guys who are responsible for the crisis, the capitalist crisis, pay for it. And then Hollande, we're not really sure what he's campaigning on. The problem is there has been such a... I'm more of a Sarkozy guy, so I see the past 5 years as some successes, some mistakes, and also a lot of Sarkozy bashing, which seems to have turned him into an untouchable for a large part of the population, meaning that it's not like they will vote against him because of his ideas. Although, yes, some of his ideas on immigration and territory control and things like that are abhorrent to them. But there's also a sense of he is horrible. We have to get rid of him.
It
almost became personal. And they won't see that he actually did a fairly good job holding us afloat with the crisis, because other European countries would have put France in the same bag as Italy and Spain, and maybe not Greece, but at least those two. And we actually aren't so in such a bad shape, and they won't attribute it to his action over the past few years. The other thing is, for things like so you understand the French psyche, they see the retirement at 62 as unfathomable, and he had to fight to get it through, and now the retirement age is 62, but everywhere else in the world, 62 is considered the minimum for retirement. For us, it was 60 until he came along. So there is a very strong disconnect, in my opinion. Again, I don't want to say make it seem like everyone thinks like that, but in my opinion, there's a very strong disconnect between what French consider normal, which is the Socialist Party, and what the rest of Europe consider normal, which oftentimes is the left, but the left for them is the social democrats, right? And I think there's a difference between the two. We shift, as I often say, a lot more to the left. And even Sarkozy, who's to the right, is very much to the left on some issues compared to the rest of Europe, like, you know, social security, unemployment benefits, education, and things like that.
So in your opinion, Patrick, do you think the French, France has benefited from Sarkozy being their president? Or do you think having someone else to change the way things have been going would benefit the country more? Like, is this because obviously it seems people are moving more towards Holland? Do you think Sarkozy is just getting penalized because of personal issues that people have with his character or his behavior or something, not with his actual the way things have been running? You know,
well, it's difficult to say, right? Because it's he certainly hasn't succeeded everywhere. I mean, even the people who voted for him 5 years ago are disappointed in what happened. So it's difficult. It's a game of, did he actually do a good job during the crisis, the world crisis that is one of the worst we've ever seen, and we would have been worse if he hadn't done what he's done? Or did he actually not do a good job, and if we had been more, I don't know, done things differently, we would have been better off? Of course, his argument is, yes, there is unemployment, it has risen, and yes, we have issues, but we were in the midst of that horrible crisis, and we could have been like Spain, but right. We're not, so I did a good job. And others will say, look at the unemployment rate, look at this, look at that, and it's your fault, which is a fair argument. What worries me, because I'm more, you know, conservative, is that Hollande's main measures are about spending money. He wants to hire 60,000 teachers immediately. That's the first thing he wants to do. And that makes me think... I don't think that's the way to go. There are other issues which Sarkozy is very strong on, which are things like immigration. And he says he's limiting immigration and making it more difficult for people to become French. And there are a lot of things like that are, again, very, very difficult to bear for the some people in the left side of the country. But Hollande will not say, for example, we have to open the borders. That obviously he wants a controlled immigration. And his base will say controlled immigration is horrible. We need to let people be in the country. And that's not reasonable. So he will be a little bit... there is some demagogy, can you say that? Some populism on the right side by saying we have to be strong on immigration. And there is populism on the left side by saying... yes, immigrants should have all these rights and all of this and all of that, when both understand that actually you have to be somewhere in the middle and you have to limit immigration, but at the same time, you know, even the left will not open the borders completely, but their base will be very angelic and say we have to welcome people who need our, you know, who want to come to France because, you know, we sing and dance Kumbaya.
I have a question for you, Patrick. In the youth, who seems to be more favorable amongst the youth, or is there a divide? And
it's hard to say. I would think Hollande. My gut instinct. I think the younger population is more favorable to the left. That's just my gut instinct. So
right. Mm.
So you guys were telling me that you had heard about the French elections in the past few weeks. How has this been reported on? Have you heard about the Front National? Or tell me, Charles, you've been very silent.
I've been very silent. I've been listening attentively. The bit that caught my eye and the bit that's been in the news was in fact Le Pen's strong showing in the first turn, and it sort of tied back to an article that I actually sent you for last month, which was around the question as to whether there was a groundswell of severe conservatism and anti-immigration and essentially racism developing in France. So that was, I guess, the connection that was drawn between the two. Yeah. A little bit, not a large article, but a bit of an alarmist article about the move in the electorate.
Yeah, it's definitely been making waves, and in France too. I mean, I don't want to diminish the impact of this. 12 years ago, was it 12 years? Yeah. Or 10 years. I can't remember. In 2002, 10 years ago, Le Pen got to the second turn. And, of course, he was swept away by a very powerful 80-something percent, I think. But yeah,
that was Le Pen Senior, yeah?
Yeah, and now it's his daughter who's...
Daughter, yeah.
So I guess that's mostly it for the French part. Do you guys, Letard and Paolo, anything else you want to add?
Well, the election obviously got exposure here in South Africa, but it was more. They just briefly talked about it as a world topic. It wasn't something that I think they really went in depth with, you know.
So it's not the oh my god, left wing is the right wing is invading France and.
No. I mean, for us, obviously, we don't get a lot of French news, yeah. Especially in politics. So it's just something that's a topic that's happening in the world. And if you want to read more into it, there's obviously that on different web pages and stuff in South Africa. But it's not something that they'll elaborate on, you know.
So I guess in Thailand, it wasn't even a blip on the radar, right?
It was a very small blip, but it was like the obligatory international news, but some importance to it because normally we don't report on international elections that much at all unless it's the USA.
Of course.
Yeah. But since we don't really right or left wing here in Thailand either, it's not like it's just reported as kind of like the facts of what's going on.
Right, yeah.
Hang on, say that again. You don't have a right or left wing?
Yeah, we don't have a real, like, conservative or liberal party. Or, so
that's intriguing.
It's not like...
So what are the differences? It's
very intriguing. So, of who can be more socialist? Because ever since from when Thaksin was elected prime minister... It was viewed that he was able to do it through kind of like socialist policies and kind of policies that would give people, kind of like giving loans and microfinance, spreading the wealth, something like that. And since the opposing party couldn't...
You're breaking up pretty badly, Letard.
Jeez.
You're breaking up pretty badly. It's difficult to understand what you're saying. So basically, you have socialists, and everyone's happy with that. So cool, and it works.
Yeah, it's kind of like I vote through policies, and it's basically each party is trying to do that right now.
We didn't catch. We're just trying
who can
to
ever
what?
Get the most votes. I'm sorry. So each part. Everything Thaksin was elected prime minister through policies that were kind of like socialist policies that spreaded money to the grassroots. The opposing party has been adopting those policies just to see if they can compete.
Yeah. Imagine that. Things that work get adopted by the two parties. That is revolutionary.
More later on.
All right. Okay. Let's move on to... the land down under. Let us know, because apparently you have almost boring politics happening in the country. I'm not sure what that is.
Almost boring. Well, look, politics, unless it's an election, tends to be kind of dull. But we've managed to spice it up a little bit with a bit of a scandal. We had a brief discussion on the constitutional setup of France. I probably need to spend a little bit of time talking about the Australian parliamentary system to introduce this.
I was hoping you would secretly.
The issue is that the Speaker of the House of Representatives, who is the position is essentially, if you like, the person who keeps order in the parliament or in the lower house of the parliament. And
the guy with a hammer.
Kind of an umpire, yeah, between the two sides of politics, yeah.
No, I meant the guy with a hammer, a hammer to, you know, say, order!
Yes, exactly, okay. That bloke. Anyway, he was recently appointed by the existing government. Actually, it's really hard to describe this because it's a very, very complex situation. We do not have a majority government in Australia at the moment, which is the first time that that's happened in my lifetime. So the Labor Party, which currently forms the government, only does so with the help of three independents. Otherwise, it would not have a majority in the government. So that, for a start, is a fairly brittle political situation.
Mm.
In order to shore up its numbers, what it actually did was it nicked the speaker from the opposition party, from their numbers, and appointed this guy, Peter Slipper, as Speaker of the House of Representatives. Now, the Speaker does not get a vote. So what they effectively did was they took a vote from the opposition and without having to take a vote from their party to appoint the Speaker. Quite a clever move. But this guy is now embroiled in a couple of different scandals. The first scandal is that he appears to have done something funny with his travel budget. Ooh, and that's currently under investigation.
I thought you were going to say done something funny with something else. Sorry.
No, that's coming. Appears to have done something funny with his travel budget. It's currently under investigation. He's produced documents which allegedly clear his name. These documents are now suspect. Essentially, this is a criminal fraud charge, and if he's found guilty of that charge, then the criminal consequences follow, and he doesn't retain his seat in Parliament. The second piece that he's in trouble with is that one of his former staffers has brought allegations of sexual harassment against him. And that's to the extent of things like inappropriate comments and inappropriate texts and suggestions and things like that. And that is currently under a civil proceeding. So he has stood down from the Speaker's chair until the criminal proceedings are sorted, but intends to take his chair back even if the civil proceedings are still pending. Now, bear in mind that the current government, the Labor Party, only holds its position as a result of the support of the three independents. And these independents actually aren't all that enamoured with Peter Slipper's behaviour. And whilst I don't necessarily think they'll withdraw their support for the current party, it is something that's putting a strain on that particular relationship. The opposition party, the Liberal Party, are absolutely loving this because remember that Peter Slipper came from their side of the floor. They were actually trying to figure out how to get rid of him because they thought he was a bit of a he was a hard person to manage and was somebody who might be prone to a couple of scandals here and there. Turns out that he has been. And so they're quietly rubbing their hands together. And what's interesting is quite often, I don't know whether your parliament's the same, but parliaments tend to be quite combative and a bit of name-calling and a bit of posturing and posing. The opposition in this case are really quite comfortable to just actually sit back and let this play out in the public arena. They don't have to do a hell of a lot to make the mud stick around this one. So, interesting times, I guess, and potentially something that could cause a double dissolution or an election and a change of government. So that's the kind of pressure that it's putting on things at the moment.
So tell me, Charles, if he gets caught... if he is found guilty in the sexual harassment case, does he have to step down from his position as well?
I actually don't know the answer to that, but I don't believe so because it's a civil case.
It's a civil case, yeah.
Right.
I mean, the public pressure, if he's found guilty...
This is what is very likely to happen, whether either charge is proven. If he attempts to take back his chair whilst either are in under investigation, there'll be what they call a vote of no confidence in the Speaker. And the news or the information is that the independents who currently support the government will support the vote of no confidence in the Speaker, and he will lose his position that way. So what's essentially, basically, it is very, very unlikely that he'll retain his position as Speaker. The flow-on effect of that is that the government needs to appoint a new speaker, will probably have to appoint that person from their own ranks, which reduces their majority margin in the House and makes their position even more precarious.
So basically, the lesson in all this is keep it in your pants or bad things happen. In this case,
that's
the fall of the Australian government.
I would not suggest that it has been out of his trousers, not at this stage. It is only allegations, and I make no representation as to the facts of the matter, Patrick.
What I'm saying is, in general, when people Yeah, when people in the situation where people don't keep it in their pants, things like that happens, and the consequence can go as far as, you know, problems with the Australian government. Actually, what am I saying? It provokes problems with the American government and the almost French government all the time. So.
Yeah. Oh no! It's a bad thing.
Yeah.
Bad.
So what were these travel costs in question?
What he appears to have done is handed over. I don't know whether there's an equivalent in any of your countries. It's something called a cab charge voucher out here, which is essentially a voucher or an expense voucher to pay for a taxi or, in this case, a limousine. And what he appears to have done is handed over blank cab charge vouchers, which the driver or whoever it is could then fill out their own amount with, and there was no control or oversight of that.
Wow! So really, that's your level of travel cost scandals?
It's that big. It's that significant. Wow. But this is
I thought it was something along the lines of going to the Maldives and, you know.
Not at all. And, you know, people do that kind of stuff and really get away with it because it's kind of like, how do you steal a canoe? You just walk out of the shop with it because no one's going to imagine that you're actually stealing it. The stuff that's really out there and in your face, people don't tend to care about. It's the kind of things that are squirreled away behind the scenes that tend to cause the biggest problems. And they're smaller, they're less significant. It's just the way it goes.
Well, I'm not trying to say, I don't think anyone is trying to say that this, you know, it should not be looked at, but yeah, certainly that wasn't the kind of scope.
So basically, to downplay it a little bit, he forged a cab receipt and now he's in serious trouble.
He forged a cab receipt and sent a couple of text messages and yeah.
And now he's in huge trouble.
Things are harsh in Australia.
Yeah. When you're a country of convicts, you have to set rules pretty...
dear.
I think that would be noticed if there were other...
The phrase cheese-eating surrender monkeys comes to mind, but I'll keep
it. Sorry, Letrad, you're breaking off all the time. Still can you repeat your question?
Yeah, I was just going to ask, if this something that would be like a big deal if there were kind of other news? I mean, has there been precedent?
Yeah, it would be because the issue is not so much what this guy's actually done. The issue is the impact that his potential departure has on the existing government. It's actually, in and of itself, if he was a backbencher for the Liberals and this was going on, no one would care. But given the position that he holds and the effect that it has on the balance of power in Parliament, that's why it's a very, very significant issue.
It makes sense, of course.
Sure, that's the real story is what it's going to affect. Not what he's done, but how it's going to affect the parties.
Now, I don't want to
cab play tab. That's outrageous, Mr. Speaker. Outrageous. Our republic cannot stand for this kind of shenaniganery. All right. The fake outrage is always something that I particularly enjoy. We get quite a bit of it in France, too. So, all right. Paolo, any fake outrage for you guys down in South Africa?
There were actually two topics I wanted to discuss. One of them was yesterday we had Freedom Day in South Africa, a national holiday for... marking the end of the apartheid and the beginning of democracy in South Africa. So something I wanted to talk about is basically the change that we've had over the years. And in my mind, I mean, I've been in and out of South Africa because I've lived overseas for quite a bit, and recently I've moved back to South Africa. And for me, I think in the beginning it was a difficult transition in the sense that you had a lot of new people in government, and there was a lot of changes and a lot of radical differences in the way things were run. And a lot of people were very concerned about what direction South Africa was going to go in. And in my opinion, it's gone in a very positive direction. I think it's been a huge success for democracy. It's been a very peaceful transition as well. I don't think, you know, I lived in the States for a while, and I found the animosity between black and whites in the States was far more apparent than it is here in South Africa. It was far more an issue there than it was for us in South Africa. Yeah, of course we have the issue. You know, it wasn't swept under the rug and forgotten about, but I think it was dealt with 100 times better than how America's been dealing with it. Because I mean, their issue with slavery and all of that in the past was nearly 100 years ago, if not more, and they still deal with a lot more issues that face to face than we do. And I think it's been a fantastic transition.
So the way that they've had to manage their transition is very different from yours, though. There was a specific point in the seismic shift and a range of effectively reverse discrimination measures that were put in place in South Africa to redress the imbalance, whereas in the United States they're having to do it organically over decades, and it's a very different approach.
You know, Rosa Parks wasn't 100 years ago, so more recent. So
right. Right.
But yeah, but it's still surprising that how long ago was it? I can't even
18 years ago, 1994.
So are you saying that now it's, I mean, I'm sure there are tensions, but are you saying now most people who 18 years ago would have been completely fine with apartheid are now maybe a little bit the younger people, or they're perfectly fine with complete equality?
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely say you'd be hard pressed to find a youth who's not for the democratic system in South Africa. I think they, especially now that the youth in school have been taught the big differences between the parties, whereas in the past, you know, it was really the one side of the story and not the other side. So people have really been able to get a better view of what democracy can do for a country. And, I'm sure you'll find people who prefer the old system, or, you know, they don't like the new system. But in a whole, I think everybody knows that this has been a better transition. It's the way it has to go because, you know, everybody's equal and everybody should be seen as equal. And South Africans, black or white or whatever color, you know, I think everybody's embraced it very openly, and it's been a very good transition from my perspective, you know. And I'm sure there's some bad cases for people, but in the whole, I think it's been a very good transition. You've seen a lot of because South Africa also had the Black Empowerment ruling, where they had to give a certain percentage of jobs to black people in South Africa to help them, you know, create more jobs and make sure that people weren't holding on to positions, you know. So affirmative action in a way. And it's been positive in the sense that you see a lot of people who 18 years ago would never have had the lifestyle they have today, and their habits, and they're doing well, and they're, you know, things are really booming for them, and they're creating business and the economy's growing because of it. I forget where I was going.
So let me ask you this. Go ahead.
Go on. I was just going to ask, is it at the point now where it's self-perpetuating, or does it still require intervention?
I think it's, I mean, you would be very hard-pressed to get things to go back the way they were. I mean, the government, is as it stands now, is very much in control, and it's mainly a black government, which is fine because it represents the majority of the population. I don't think there's any type of intervention needed, because the current government is actually self-regulating very well. We've actually had an issue with a young and upcoming politician, and the current government he was part of the African National Congress, which is the primary, the the big party here, and they're the ruling party at the moment. And he was very radical in a lot of things. And the last time I was on the show, I talked to you guys, you and Turkey, about it, where he wanted to nationalize all the mines in South Africa, and he was doing, he was talking about very radical things. And I think the party itself said, no, this is getting out of control. He's getting too much support. It's not what we want for South Africa. And they recently have thrown him out and taken him to court. And, you know, there's been a lot of corrupt allegations that have gone to court. And, you know, he's been basically
anything to do with taxis?
No, there's a lot more stuff with planes and holidays and exotic locations. But
you guys are just not at the cutting edge of corruption.
Can I ask you? I'm sorry. I just wanted to ask, do you know anyone kind of like personally that has made the transition on a personal note? I'm just curious as to kind of like what has made them kind of reform so quickly.
Because what do you mean by... Like,
kind of like, you know, blacks are getting more acceptance, you know. Do you know someone that has kind of like changed their attitudes yourself?
Definitely day to day I meet and deal with people who have, in the past, I would never be able, because I do business with these people, and they, in the past, I would have never been able to do business with, because I'm a white South African, and I would have never been able to do business with a black person in that manner. And today I deal with them and more than proficient, no problems at all, and there's no animosity to us.
I think the question, Paolo, I think the question was more, you know, maybe someone who's a little bit older who was living in the apartheid, you know, world 20 years ago, and who had to make that transition of considering black people as inferior to then all of a sudden, I don't know, having to consider them equal.
Right. Yeah, sure. No, and I do know a fair amount of people who are in that position where they now see black people as an equal, and they've become far more accepting of them. I mean, the majority, all white South Africans have had to be in that position.
But and how does that work? Do you have an insight into the, from, you know, one day to the next, or 1 year to the next, maybe all of a sudden you completely change your view of the world? Or is it that most people already, you know, the rest of the world had already done with that way of thinking, so people knew that this situation in South Africa was kind of, if not condemned to change, at least not the norm?
Well, I think a lot of people overseas have a misconception about the way a lot of South Africans were back then, because I think everybody assumed that every white South African was in this position where they were like, oh, no, we don't see black people as an equal. There was a fair amount of people in South Africa who knew the system was wrong. You know, they were just benefiting from the system, if anything. But they knew that, I mean, the rest of the world's running in a completely different way. Why is our way the right way? You know, and I mean, one of my uncles, he was someone who was an activist for the blacks, and he hid them in his house, all of the politicians, all of the because the ANC movement that's in government today, they were trying to gain momentum at that time. And they were hiding in houses, and, you know, all of their key figures like Mandela, you know, they had to be hidden in a way, you know. And there were people who did support party, you know, and they came to power. The ANC came to power because of that, because those people in South Africa were also putting pressure on the government to change. And there are some, you can say that there are some people who don't agree with the current system, but they're few and far between, in my opinion. You know, from my experience in South Africa and dealing with South Africans, white and black, there are very few and far between people who say, no, this, the old system is the way it should be, and I don't see this person as an equal. I think everybody does, you know, and it's been a, like I said, it's been a good change in the mindsets of people as well. They have accepted it in a very open arms
so,
way. You know?
But if it was already sort of a situation where it was understood that well, the one you described, how come it didn't change before that? Was it because, as you were saying, some people were profiting from the situation? Or
yeah, I think it was very it had a lot to do with that, where a lot of key people were very much benefiting from the fact that they were able to keep their thumb on a large percentage of the population. You know, if you have the majority of your population not living as well as you are, and you're controlling them, you can benefit from that in many ways. And they were also very self-sufficient. That was another key part of it, is that they, the rest of the world ostracized us. They said, oh, embargo on South Africa, you know, we're not giving you any products or support, and we're not accepting anything you out. And I remember as a kid, when we were traveling in and out of South Africa, because I lived outside of South Africa at that point, we could never fly directly to certain countries because they wouldn't accept flights from South Africa. So I lost my train of thought.
No problem.
Was France part of the sanctions against South Africa during the apartheid era?
Yes, I couldn't tell you.
I think they were almost all countries in Europe were, and we survived on our own because of it. Like, we were able, because we have a lot of resources. It's not to say we couldn't get minerals and things. We have a lot of farmland. You know, we could support ourselves. We actually even started our own nuclear program at the time, because we've got a lot of uranium, and obviously that's not a good thing. But South Africa was very much in their own little bubble at that point. And when the rest of the world was really putting pressure on us to change, obviously for good reasons, but they were saying, no, you guys got to change. And South Africa was like, well, we don't really need the rest of you. We can do it on our own, type thing. Mm. But then within South Africa, there was also a lot of pressure from the black population, and growing pressure from the white population. So the government was really at a crossroads where they had to change. And they changed in a direction that's obviously been very good for the country.
There's another aspect that I think, I'm sure we've already discussed, but I want to ask you again. The issue of violence, because maybe a little bit under 10 years ago, the image we had of South Africa in general was of an incredibly violent country where safety was one of the main concerns. Has that been resolved, or was it not really the case?
In my opinion, especially after coming to South Africa, I've come and gone over the years after living overseas, and I've seen big changes pre-apartheid, post-apartheid, and in the new government. And I think the big thing that happened during that period, when everybody was seeing South Africa under such a bad light because crime was rampant, and, you know, what really happened in my mind is that the new government took power, and they put a lot of people in key positions who may not have had experience in those positions ever before, you know. And what happened was, we were having a lot of governmental change in police forces, in fire forces, in all aspects of government. You know, it wasn't just to say that the parliament had changed. You know, all aspects of the government was changing, and new people were being put in positions that they may necessarily had never had experience in. And what ended up happening was, our police force became very weak. So we had a lot of police who decided they didn't want to be a part of the police force anymore because of the new government, you know, and they were worried about what was going to happen to them. And in doing so, the police force wasn't as strong as it should have been. And we have a very high poverty rate. And crime began to take off because of that. And then we had a lot of violent crime because we had a lot of African immigrants from more like from the Congo and from Nigeria that were far more aggressive. So we had a lot of these immigrants who came in and took advantage of the fact that there wasn't a strong police force. And now, after 18 years or so, the police force has really started to get a lot of flack because of the fact that they haven't been, you know, solving a lot of these problems. And in my opinion, they have really stepped up their game. I've seen after the World Cup that we had here in South Africa, they've really been clamping down a lot of stuff. And in South Africa, you might meet people who say, "Yeah, oh, no, crime's a problem." Yeah, sure, it's a problem. But in my opinion, it's gotten 10 times, a million times better than it was. And I see an improvement every day. And it's difficult to see it when you live here, but I personally think things are getting much better in that respect, you know. Okay. And that's my reason.
Okay, fair enough.
Can I pick out something in particular that you said there, Paolo?
Yeah, sure.
You spoke about the issue that immigrants from, I think you said Congo and Nigeria, was it? That were more aggressive. So we've spoken briefly about Patrick's immigration issues and how that's a political hotspot in France.
Oh boy.
Is the similar sort of thing an issue in South Africa?
Yeah, it's a big issue in
border
South
control.
Africa. Yeah, because what happened is during the apartheid, the borders were closed. Nobody was really allowed to come and go from the African countries and neighboring African countries. And once the ANC took power, they opened up all the borders and they said, "No, you know, everybody in Africa is welcome to come to South Africa." Obviously not to stay, but what ended up happening is we got a mass immigration to South Africa, because here's this wealthy country in Africa that's got a lot of opportunity. So we've had mass immigration, especially from Zimbabwe, because Zimbabwe's really been in trouble. And if you're a family and your wife and your kids are starving, you need to find opportunity that will provide for them. And if it's across the border, you're going to take advantage of that. And we've had a lot of mass immigration from Zimbabwe and also other parts of Africa. And because of that, the local population has become very xenophobic towards Zimbabweans and Nigerians and stuff, because they see them as coming in working for less and taking their jobs, which they feel is their right, you know. And we have a big problem in that respect with immigration, from especially illegal immigration.
Mm. Yeah. Mm. All right. I guess you wanted to discuss something else, or should we move on?
Well, another topic, I don't know if I talked quite a bit there, but I wanted to talk about Zimbabwe. They have recently been trying to have elections. And for me, especially, a lot of Africa doesn't get exposure in certain issues, and this is one of those cases, I feel, because Mugabe, who's the current president of Zimbabwe, he brought democracy to Zimbabwe. And he brought it to Zimbabwe in the 80s. And he was supposed to have a regular 8-year term of being president. And over the time, he's gone by and he said, "Well, I kind of really like being president." So he's been president since the 1980s. And he keeps running elections where there's a saying where they said if there was a vote on a boat and there were 6 people, Mugabe would get 9 votes. You know, he would... he's that type of person, or that's the type of thing that's going on in Zimbabwe where it's not really a free and fair election. And I have worked with a lot of Zimbabweans, obviously, because they come here to South Africa for work and, you know, they're trying to make a life. And they have told me that they're really hoping that this election changes things, and that it's just been postponed now because people have been unhappy with the way they think that it's not going to be another fair election. So for me, my big thing is... Go ahead, sorry.
From memory, the last election, the main opposition candidate, whose name escapes me, was it Chandrai or something like that?
Yeah,
wasn't there supposed to be a power-sharing arrangement with Mugabe out of that?
Yeah, but from what I understand is that it kind of all fell through, and he stepped down, and Mugabe kind of just took back power, you know. And kind of, from what I understand, from the people I've talked to, he kind of really does what he wants, you know. He's kind of like, well, I don't really want to work with you, so go away type thing, you know. And I don't think it gets much exposure, also because in Zimbabwe he controls the media. You know, he's like, I don't really want to talk about these issues in the news, so let's talk about something happy, you know. And it's kind of like that video I showed you pre the show, where he wasn't happy with the fact that this company brought this
video. Can you explain what the video is for the people listening?
The video is basically a montage of Mugabe, and they're singing, what's the song? Those Were the Days.
Yeah.
And they have Gaddafi. He's playing in the garden.
Mugabe is setting a table for six, but no one's at the table, so he's remembering the good old days of when he had his dictator friends coming and having fun with him, doing what Paolo would describe now.
Yeah, and it cuts back to a memory of his where he's with Gaddafi, and they're both in the garden, like having fun and shooting each other with water pistols and having a laugh. And then it cuts to another scene where Saddam and him are playing in the sand, and you know, and the gist of it is basically that he's the last dictator that's left, and the ad is for like, buy this meal of Nando's chicken meal, and you know, you can share with many people, like you don't have to be alone type thing. And when he saw that, he said, no, I don't like this, cut this, take this out, you know. And immediately was taken off the media, fortunately.
Of course,
YouTube is our friend. And
you know, it's interesting, because this is actually something that is very true, and we were discussing a year ago about the fact that there are no more, you know, big dictators anywhere at this point.
Right.
So,
and Mugabe is—he's an old man now, so I don't foresee him being around much longer, you know. But there's definitely been a shift in powers, and I think that's got a lot to do with the fact that media around the world has become far more accessible to anybody, and not your local media.
Charles, you're siloning. Can you unplug your... I'm not sure that's the problem, but try to unplug and replug your mic if you can.
All right.
The siloning curse that has become famous across all podcasts in the world.
My big thing was really I just wanted to bring... awareness to it, because obviously in Zimbabwe they don't.
Not really.
Okay.
That is strange. Let's okay, keep going, Paolo. Hopefully we'll.
I was basically just saying, like, you know, the thing in Zimbabwe is it really doesn't get any exposure, and in the rest of the world there's a lot of stuff that's happening all the time, you know, big events, and Africa's very much fallen by the wayside, because Africa's always a tragic case, and you know, people don't see it. And I think for Zimbabwe especially, here's a country that they were doing really well at one point, you know, when Mugabe did take power, they were seen as the breadbasket of Africa. They produced a lot of goods, you know, they were doing very well. And now, because he's kind of taken control and he doesn't relinquish any control, the country has suffered from it. And you know, I feel badly for the country, and I hope in their future that they turn in the same direction that we've turned, you know.
Let's hope. And certainly we haven't heard a lot about it in France, so yeah, same thing here. All right, Charles, can you try speaking?
All right, how's that?
It works.
Hey.
Fantastic.
I was going to say, when you said there are no more dictators in the world, wait 20 years, because my guess is that most of these people weren't dictators day one. Mugabe is an excellent example of somebody who basically freed a country from colonial rule, and was the new hope until he didn't stand down.
Okay, can we enjoy the situation for a second before
no,
you
I'm
ruin
be a cynical
it?
Old bastard, and that is just me.
No, you know, I don't know. I mean, there's certainly there's a chance that that will happen, but I think the key there is the economy, and if we manage to get a healthy economy going, I don't see a reason why they should devolve back into into dictatorship more than and that's a big if, obviously. Yeah, I mean, there are
you're going to get the pinko socialist coming at me now because you know, define healthy economy for me. What does that mean? Does that mean
we haven't had major conflicts.
Corporations?
We haven't had major conflicts in the Western world in the past 50 years, so.
See, I don't necessarily agree with you, Charles, because I think as time's gone by, we have something that the past never had, which is this: we're becoming far more of a globalized economy. You know, we're becoming far more connected. Like South Africa, unlike the past, now we depend on the rest of the world. We can't afford to sit in a bubble and say we're not going to do that, because now we need goods from China. We need goods from Europe. We need all these things that interlink us. And for us to sit by and let someone take power and get crazy, I don't know if the population would allow that. But look,
it's reason why the U.S. and China are playing so well, even though they're, you know, supposedly so. I mean, everything opposes them. But they are so codependent.
About where the power actually sits nowadays. And pre-show, I briefly mentioned the Leveson inquiry in the United Kingdom into media power. One of the things that they're talking about there is Rupert Murdoch and his influence over the political decision makers in the United Kingdom, and he has testified in front of the Leveson inquiry recently and said something along the lines of, "I have never asked any British Prime Minister for a favour." Now, Murdoch runs some of the most powerful and important newspapers and media outlets in the United Kingdom, and the general thought is that no, he probably never has asked a politician for a favour because he's never had to. That, in fact, where we've got our dictatorships is now in places like private enterprise, where somebody like Murdoch can potentially exert his influence over a government and have decisions made in his favour.
Now, that I agree with. But that's a corporate power versus a political power.
Translated into the political world, but I take your point.
All right. Let's move on to Thailand, if we can, because your connection seems to be very capricious today, Letad. Let's try.
Yeah, sorry about that. Does it sound okay now?
Yeah, now you're sounding fine. I was very wise to wait for such a long time.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I fixed some things.
Oh, but, okay. Well, then you were wise to fix some things, too.
So things have been a bit political, so I guess I'll kind of like maybe just to allude to what I was talking about before, just to give you a background of Thailand. So before until very recently, and by recent I would say maybe about 10 years, or about the same age as when Thaksin Shinawat first became prime minister, we did not have a real kind of real political parties based on beliefs such as being liberal or socialist. Mm-hmm. It was more of only before the election of Thaksin Shinawat's party, I would say Congress, they were elected by kind of counting, not based on parties. So it's more of kind of regionals or districts, and then each member would be supported by a party, but I mean the party are kind of more like a sports clubs. They are
sports club.
Yeah, I would say that because politicians would change between parties pretty frequently, and people would not have like this distinct feeling about they betrayed their beliefs. So it was kind of like there would be transfers among people, and we were fun with that. Because we were founded
cool
kind
system,
of like
actually.
It. Well, the background is that we changed from kind of a monarchy to a democratic system, but we still have the monarchy, the king as kind of like this symbolic monarch. But at the same time, though, there are royalists that do have influential power in Thailand, and that is kind of like the issue here with Thaksin's dealings with Thailand and how he's coming back. His main opposition, as of now, has been viewed as kind of a fight between the royalists and Thaksin's people. So the main news is that during Thaksin's second term, there was a coup, and he fled the country, and he has not been back ever since. And after that, during his time, there were a group called the Yellow Shirts, and then after that, there was an opposing group formed called the Red Shirts. And the Red Shirts are kind of the people that are supporting Thaksin. And the Red Shirts are comprised of, I guess we would call them the grassroots, but they are the majority of the people. And the Yellow Shirts were originally kind of seen as the middle class and upwards, the people who basically lived in Bangkok. And there was a smaller amount of people. So every time there was an election for the past years, Thaksin's party has always won, even though he had fled the country and he was no longer the prime minister. But it was always seen that all the prime ministers after that were proxies for Thaksin. But 6 years later,
does he have an influence, like an actual influence on the politics of the country? Or
it is seen that way. It is seen that way.
Yeah, but he speaks with the people who are elected, or?
So he would call in through Skype, through gatherings with the Red Mob. So the Thai people are very educated. They know what Skype is because of Thaksin. So he taught Thai Twitter and Skype. But yeah, so he would Skype in. He would phone in and talk with the people and explain policies and why the policies, why his party is using that policy and this policies and things like that. So at the same time, he has been careful to not get caught. So he lived in England for a while, and now he's in Dubai. But this year, during the Thai New Year, it was the first time that he personally came to address the Red Mob, the Red Shirts. But it was not based. He originally came but claimed that he would be in he would visit in Thailand, but he has since shied away, and instead he based his dealings his gathering at Cambodia.
Okay.
Yeah. So he has made friends in Cambodia, and all the Red Shirts they traveled and held a big Thai New Year party with him in Cambodia. And that was mainly seen as kind of like a symbolic thing that he is coming back soon. And it kind of made waves in that he held it in at the Thai New Year, which is basically the biggest festival of the country. And it's kind of showed that the people that supported him were still strong, and that he is ready to come back anytime.
So, but okay, sorry, I might have missed it. Why did he leave in the first place?
I'm sorry. Yeah, there was a coup, so he was overthrown.
Right. So the interesting thing is, how can he come back?
He can come back because it is Thailand. So legally, he cannot come back because he was accused of many charges, but legally, he has only been found guilty of one, which is he did not pay taxes on his stock dealings.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of, that was the only one that he was found guilty of. So he could not actually come back and run for prime minister. But the people that supports him will always think that there's a way for him to be pardoned. So there is actually a way. So kind of the pardon system is made by the king every year. So there has been calls for like him to be pardoned for that dealing or something like that. But Thaksin himself claims that he will not come back until kind of like the judging system is more fair, or so he claims.
Hmm. Okay. All right. I guess, is that it for Thailand?
Yeah, so I think it's an interesting point for the country itself, because in our kind of small world, we are one of the biggest in like the Southeast Asian community. And although we are not big on the world stage, we are kind of well known inside our own little area. And we have kind of been stalling for the past several years. And it's kind of like a turning point for the country right now about what's going on next. So there's a view that we are at an impasse, and there's no real way that we can move on from this, because the red shirts keep winning, but they still keep being opposed by kind of like a lot of people that are in power behind the scenes. And at the same time, we are entering the AEC, or the Southeast Asia, it's called the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, but it's kind of basically kind of like the EU, in that it's a economic agreement. Supposedly, we are going to make it official by around 2015 and establish free trade areas. And that would make us...
It's the economy, stupid.
Yeah, that would kind of make us the top 10 economy. And it's kind of like a view that if we do not get sorted out soon, as when that happens, we'll get crushed by all the country, all the other countries.
So let's start with all this going on. Is there any room for growth within the country, or is everything just stagnant because of this?
Everything is stagnant. So there are. So alluding to when I mentioned that parties do not have kind of a core belief, they kind of just roll out policies. The current party is kind of like the most, has rolled out basically the most outrageous. So the current party is still Thaksin's party, but they roll out policies such as increasing the minimum wage to 300 baht. So the average minimum wage before this was about 160 baht. But now that it's in effect, it's 300 baht, and they are doing a lot of guaranteeing minimum prices for many things, basically to claim that claiming that they want to help the grassroots people, things like that. They're making enemies out of the rich people and trying to say the rich people don't care, kind of like the 1% or something like that. But the minimum wage policy is like the best example of like an outrageous policy that is pretty clear that it is not good for the country, but it has won them votes and has made them the ruling party.
They're just trying to buy votes, even though they're not realistic votes, realistic goals.
They're not realistic goals. Yes, they got real votes and they secured the majority of the people, but people view it as it's going to ruin the economy. So it's stagnant in that way, in that we are basically should still be an agricultural country. It's our main GDP. But there's
really, it's not tourism? For some reason, I thought tourism was so huge in Thailand. But
it's second. So okay. We still produce rice, fruits. Mm. We have climate. Produce both cold weather and warm weather fruits. But if the minimum wage is coming up, what's happening is that, so Thailand's kind of like, if Thailand was only lived in Southeast Asia, we'd be kind of similar to the United States. A lot of Thais don't want to work at farms anymore. They do not work in factories. Mm-hmm. So the labor would actually be people from Myanmar. So not really Chinese, because the Chinese are kind of like the higher upper class in Thailand.
So is Thailand in the same boat as everyone else, where everything's coming from China in that respect?
Yes, because one of the problems is that our main selling point for multinational companies such as USA is that we are not China. So
that's a good point.
Right. So it's like, okay, Thailand makes it like double the wage cost, but at least in China, we used to be seen as more trustworthy, and
at
we still
least we're not China. That's a great argument.
And at the same time, we have strong China because the upper class are mostly of Chinese descendants. Mm.
How's the relationship with Myanmar going at the minute? Sorry, just sidebarring there for a kick.
Of course. Yeah. So, historically, we have been at war with Myanmar and Cambodia for a long time. I'm sorry, did you say Cambodia or Myanmar?
Myanmar.
Okay, so they've kind of like faded into the background because more recently it's more about Cambodia. Mm. But so they have not come up. So we're more of kind of like more involved with our own political problems, and we don't have time for. In the news, in the mainstream news, we don't seem to have time for international politics. But at the same time, in the south of Thailand, there are shootings every day, and it's not safe to travel there. But but it's not being covered by the mainstream press, but partly because I think it's kind of like a sensitive issue about who's actually behind everything that's going on in the south. Some people, some accuse it of Malaysia. Some people accuse, other political parties. And right now, it's a very dangerous state in that schools can be bombed at any time. It's not safe to be police, and soldiers can get killed every day.
Hmm.
So when you look. When Thailand's actually going through a pretty chaotic state.
It definitely seems like there's a lot more happening than I was aware of. I wasn't aware of much, so that's not saying a lot, but still.
Yeah, we're kind of like...
Are you saying that there's a feeling now in Thailand, across the country, and maybe especially with the youth, that... Thailand's time is coming, kind of, or like we're getting to a state where things are going to be changing and amazing with Asian Association of Asian Countries and things like that? Or is it just that's what's happening and that's it? Or is there actually a feeling of change in the country?
General feeling is that we're like heading to something bad, like very bad.
Oh, okay.
We don't see a real solution coming out. We don't know how the country is going to head. It's headed. We don't know who the real leader of the country is going to be, and we don't feel we're actually that prepared for the AEC, the Economic Union.
Hmm.
And the general feeling among youth is that they just don't know. It's kind of like we don't have much alternatives. It's not like we can just simply move countries, but at the same time, we don't know kind of like what we can do to change things, because throughout all of this, we do not feel like we actually know what is actually going on.
Meaning, you say we don't know what's going on, you mean?
After all the red shirts and the yellow shirts, at the modern time, people are starting to come to realize that there's no real good guy in all of this. Thaksin was, especially in the first term, people did not accept at the same time, but now that things have been a bit more quiet, he was good for the country, but at the same time, he's flawed, and he has been made, he's been accused of many corruption charges. And so now
now you're basically choosing between the lesser of two evils in regards to voting.
Yes, people don't know who to vote for, basically, because although I mentioned that Thaksin's party has won all of the elections that has happened since then, there was one time when, although his party won the majority of votes, he won most of the votes, but not enough to be like the single party that led the government. So, there was this election that they won, and we had a prime minister, Somaksin Thorawet, but he got impeached for he had to step down because he was found guilty of he used to host a cooking show, and it was found that he was legally he could not hold another job while when he became prime minister.
That's fantastic. Okay, that will bring, will crush your confidence in a political person or or system even. What kind of... Yeah. I'm sorry, guys. I'm going to have to cut this conversation short. I have to go. It's getting a little bit late. So we can, you know, we can conclude in 5-10 minutes and then we have to close it down. So please finish your thoughts, Latrad, but after we're going to have to go.
Yeah. So basically we do not feel like the feeling is that we do not feel like we have a real democratic system because of the kinds of things like what I just talked about. But for both parties, like the supporter, the anti-Thaksin people feel like the mass majority of people are being fooled, but at the same time the red shirts, they feel like they're not getting being treated fairly. And so it's kind of feeling that for the yellow shirts or for like the Bangkok people, there has been talk that's like, we don't have a real democratic system, but we don't know if we should. So the people in Bangkok are kind of like more aligned towards the monarchy and the king and the royalists. So I don't know. Things are very unsure in Thailand. And we have kind of always been through peaceful times, and we have never had like riots. So during the war, we were taken over by the Axis or the Allies. So this is kind of like the first for the modern age Thailand to go through.
Well, you can tell your friends and your people that if they want, you know, to give the leadership to someone that is sure to make something good, I'm up for it. You know, I can, I would be but I would need a new title though, like the chief honcho person of Thailand. That would work for me. But I take
it rolls off the tongue really nicely,
yes,
Patrick.
I agree.
Now we view the French kind of nice people, you know. We have good image towards the French.
Oh, see? So, it works. It could work. I would make, you know, wine and cheese mandatory and like
Hang on. France didn't have Thailand as a colonial subject, did it? No. You were in Vietnam and Cambodia and places like that, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
So we're good, right? It works.
As long as you don't have a cooking show.
Don't have cooking shows. They'll get you impeached.
All right. I'll keep that in mind.
No.
All right, gentlemen. Thank you very much for coming on the show. Before we go, please let us know where we can find you on the internets after the show has concluded. Let's start. I have to say someone's name, don't I? Let's start with Charles.
Very simple. I'm nowhere on the internet unless you want to follow me at Extrepid on Twitter, and I say nothing interesting. So by all means, do that if you want.
You're really selling your presence really well. Impressive.
There's a couple of nice photos of the Victorian High Country that I was at over the last couple of days, if you want to look at those. But no, that's about it, really.
I'll do that right now. What about you, Paolo?
People can find me on Twitter at Paolo Audio, Paulo Audio
at Twitter.
Yeah, Twitter.
And what about you, Letard?
Yeah, I also say nothing interesting on Twitter at Lertad, Lertad.
All right. Well, yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
Basically any social network, I use that name. Instagram, whatever.
Yeah, you're very lucky in the sense that you have a name that is
unique,
very rare. Yeah, very nice.
Exactly.
For me, it's Not Patrick, and similarly, I'm Not Patrick almost everywhere, so that's easy to remember too. That is going to be it for the show today, and we will be back in a month with another round of guests and fantastic stories that hopefully will include more international topics. And we'll see you then. Bye.
podcast is part of the Frog Pants Studios Network. For more information about this and other shows, visit frogpants.com. Audio program so good, it's like you're there.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.